Hey everyone, I'm Jacob Cohen Donnelly and this is A Media Operator. This show is a discussion about building media companies for current and prospective media operators. We discuss business models, products, subscriptions, advertising, commerce, events, everything to help you build your media business. To learn more and to become a premium member of AMO, visit amediaoperator.com/membership and use the coupon code PODCAST10 to get 10% off an annual plan. My guest this week is Isaac Saul, the founder of Tangle, a political publication that looks to summarize the best arguments from across the political spectrum. In this hour-long conversation, we talked about the brand's exceptional free-to-paid conversion rate, where they're exploring advertising and events, the major headwinds the brand and all political media is dealing with, and how he and the team plan to overcome it. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Special thanks to Seb Poe for making this episode possible. So let's start at the very beginning. What is Tangle, and how and why did you find yourself launching this brand?
Yeah, great question. So I started Tangle sort of for two reasons. I think one was a response to what I was seeing in the media industry, specifically how political news was being covered across the space. And the other was a response to what I was seeing in my personal life, which is basically that people who disagree politically have a hard time being in the same room together anymore. And I grew up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is part of my Genesis story. I talk about it a lot. It's a bellwether county in a bellwether state, very politically divided, lots of class divisions. In my high school, my friends growing up, across my family, there are just people who have really different political beliefs. And when I came into the media world, you know, I got my start in journalism at the Huffington Post, notorious left-leaning news outlet. I sort of saw how the sausage was made, I think, and the way in which people played to their audience a little bit in that space. And from there forward in my media career, I think I got a lot better at spotting some of the signals news outlets were sending out to appeal to specific readers or viewers or listeners. And this is, of course, not just true on the left, it's true on the right too. And so I was sort of keen to the news bubble thing, I think, before it became really popularized and well known. I mean, in 2012, 2013, it was very obvious to me from Facebook and Twitter that people were kind of operating in a very insulated manner. Now everybody sort of knows this, that, you know, your feed gives you more of what you like. And so news outlets try and sort of give red meat to the base. And I wanted to build something where people from across the political spectrum could come together. So I started this Substack newsletter where we'd tackle one big political debate every day. And we would explicitly share opinions from the left and the right about that debate. So, you know, if you read our newsletter from top to bottom, you would have a really holistic understanding of how different political parties and different political minds from across the spectrum, from the sort of lefty Bernie Sanders to the establishment Democrat to the never Trump Republican to sort of the far right Trump intellectual types, were thinking about the issue. And then I share a little bit of my take too in every newsletter. And we've been building an audience that I think is representative of what we're doing, that is made up of people from a lot of different political backgrounds.
So I have a inherent bias against political content, just because I think, like most people, we're kind of tired of it. And my belief, I've had debates with friends about this, that the only way to make money in political media is to take an intense slant. You are obviously proof against that. So why do you believe, like, what is the audience telling you that makes you believe that there is a space for this center or both sides debate?
Yeah. So first of all, I think it's important to talk about why I think a lot of those media companies fail that try and walk this line. And I think it's literally because it's boring. I mean, I think news is sort of, walking the line of entertainment. And when news outlets try and do this, either very neutral language or just, you know, a kind of all sides or flip side type, here's what the left's saying, here's what the right's saying. There's something that happens there that I think is a little bit dry for a lot of readers. And that kind of, I guess, suppresses a level of engagement that the more partisan news outlets have that I think is really important. So what we've done as a way to kind of address that is I share my own take, which, you know, is an act of transparency, in my opinion, because it's telling the readers, here's the person who's providing your information, how they actually feel about the arguments that we're sharing. So it's sort of me saying, like, all my cards on the table and you can take it or leave it. And B, it creates a space for a little bit of controversy and a little bit of engagement and something for the readers to say, oh, I didn't like how you said that, and have a little bit of the dialogue and the back and forth. And I think that makes the whole newsletter just a lot more interesting. It makes the podcast a lot more interesting that there's this one person who's behind it versus a sort of unaccountable, you know, media brand that doesn't really reply to you at all. So I think that's part of why we've done so well organically. And what I hear from readers and listeners is basically two things. One, they feel a personal attachment to me, you know, that I get that a lot. Like, it, if my view changes on an issue and I write about why it's changed, people will say, you know, that it's been so interesting to watch you evolve here, and I feel like I've been along for the journey, et cetera. And then they also say that what we're doing and what we're providing is turning the temperature down. They feel less crazy when they read our newsletter or listen to our podcast, because they're not just getting one side saying the world's on fire, the other side's evil. They're getting an actual holistic look at the arguments, which I think whenever you do that, not whenever, but most of the time you do that, you're going to come to the conclusion that there's some nuance about the debate that's happening. There's a reason it's a debate, because, you know, it's probably not as simple and black and white as some people want to make it seem. So we definitely hear from folks who feel like they have a little bit more level-headed news consumption diet with us in it. And I think, you know, I'm personally really proud of that, because I think there's far too much sensationalism and exaggeration and kind of scare tactics and fear in the media space right now.
And how do you avoid falling into the trap of false balance or both-sidism?
Yeah, this is one of the questions we get probably most often, or maybe I should say one of the accusations we get most often. So there's a couple different ways we think about how we select the stories or the opinions that we're going to share. So the general construct of the newsletter is we'll introduce a topic in the most, I guess you could say, neutral language possible. So maybe how it would look in a place like Reuters or The Hill or something like that, where it's a very kind of bland explanation of the hopefully, you know, non-debatable facts. And then we share arguments from the left, then we share arguments from the right. When we pick those arguments, we're looking for a combination of arguments that are representative of what we think the mood of the, you know, the political tribes are. So, you know, if there's an issue like Israel and what's happening in Gaza, where the left is really divided, we're not going to just say that everybody on the left is saying, you know, that we should force Israel to pull out of Gaza or whatever, because a lot of people on the left don't feel that way. There are a lot of Democrats who are very pro-Israel. So we'll share kind of a mixed bag on the left, and we'll try and make it representative. And that's primarily our goal, is to show you what people are actually thinking and believing from the two predominant political tribes. After that, we start looking for arguments that are sort of maybe dissenting opinions from the tribes. We look for arguments that we personally as a staff find really compelling. So things that just stuck out as being a really cogent or well-rounded argument, or something that brought a kind of fresh take to the one side or the other's perspective on the issue. And, you know, a lot of people will say, how would you cover, you know, an issue like climate change or something like that, where there's going to be a lot of voices on the right who maybe are doubting whether climate change is actually real or not, and you're going to weigh both those things equally? And the answer is we don't, because I have my take section every day where I get to call some balls and strikes. And that is sort of my way of saying, like, here's what I think about this argument that this side's making that strikes me as a crappy argument. And B, we make it clear, as is true with most issues, that everybody on the left and right isn't totally in unison. They don't agree, or maybe they agree, but they don't agree for the same reason. So, you know, I usually get this question from people who are sort of oriented more politically to the left, who will say, like, how are you going to give both sides to claims of the election being stolen or something? And I just say, look, we're going to share opinions from the right of people saying that the election wasn't stolen, because a lot of people on the right feel that way. And I'm going to say, I don't think the election was stolen because I don't think it was. And then everybody on the left is going to say that. And so, you know, maybe you get five opinions saying that it's clear the election wasn't stolen and two saying it was, and you just have to live with those two and actually engage the argument in like an honest, open-minded way. It's a really difficult balance to strike, but that's part of the challenge of our work, and it's something we try and navigate every day.
So let's jump right into the business model then. You describe on the website the publication as a subscriber-supported newsletter read by over 90,000 people in 55-plus countries around the world. What percentage of the revenue comes from paid subscribers?
Over 90%. We only introduced advertising into the newsletter in Q4 of 2023. So it's actually a fairly new venture for us to have paid ad slots. They show only to free subscribers. So we sort of now have kind of a freemium model where the free readers will see the advertisements, but the paid subscribers will not. We have, I think, about 15,000 paid subscribers now. We make a little bit of money off of merch sales and a little bit of money off of donations and a little bit of money off some of the events that we've done. But yeah, over 90%, maybe even like 93 or 94% of our revenue comes directly from paying subscribers. And in exchange for that subscription, those subscribers get Friday editions, which are typically kind of exclusive, more unique, original, deep dive type content. Sometimes it's works of journalism that I've been working on, you know, original reporting. Sometimes it's just transcriptions of interviews I do with people. Sometimes it's a personal opinion piece or, you know, a deep dive on an issue that's maybe more aggregated and less reported. But it's generally just, you know, kind of premium-esque content. And then on Sundays, we have a newly launched Sunday newsletter that's also part of the paid subscriptions. And that's sort of like our take on the Sunday Times. So it's, you know, comics and a puzzle we created and, you know, some quotes of the week and some roundups of our coverage and that kind of stuff. And so far, people seem to really like that. We didn't really know how that was going to go, but it's been pretty successful so far. So yeah, we are subscription first. In my opinion, that is the most sustainable way to build a media company right now. I think it is also the one that has the least dangerous incentives for people who are on the content side. So I'm super excited because, you know, I've worked in this space for 10 years, and this is the first time I've ever been at a company that relied on subscription revenue, and it's my company, and it feels really good to be there because, you know, I'm not looking at the clock on Friday every week hoping that I don't get a layoff email before 5 o'clock, basically.
So roughly 90,000 people, 15,000 paid subscribers, so about a 16% conversion rate. What have you found, like what tactics have you found work particularly well to get people from the free list to the paid list? Because 16% is a pretty strong conversion rate.
Yeah, we're super proud of that. It's one of my favorite metrics to tell people about our content, and a super low churn rate too. I think less than 1% or something. 90% of those subscribers are on yearly subscriptions. So it's a really consistent, reliable revenue stream. We do a few things. I mean, the one that has always worked the best for me is a really personal, honest, just ask, you know, like a dedicated email. We do about two of them a year, where I just write to everybody on the free list. The subject line often will say something very direct and kind of cheeky, like I'm asking for your money, or this is an email asking for your money, or something like that. And I say explicitly, just a lot of news organizations beat around the bush. I'm not going to beat around the bush. I'm writing to you because I want you to give me a subscription. here are the things you get when you subscribe. Here are the five reasons it's really important for us that you subscribe. And, you know, if you're not ready or you just signed up, I understand. But, you know, let me know what would make it more compelling for you to jump on board and then read some of those emails. And, you know, we usually get hundreds of subscribers from that. The second thing that's really, really effective for us is in our welcome email flow, we just immediately offer people a 20% discount right after they subscribe. And it's similarly kind of a personalized email. It's a picture of me with a note about why I started Tangle, and just it's a welcome page that just says, like, this is an offer. When you exit out, it's going to disappear, which actually isn't true. We just say that, but it's, you know, they could theoretically, they could find the URL again if they wanted to. And just same deal. Here's a 20% off offer. And like, here's why this subscription is important, and put a little bit of urgency behind it. And people tend to respond well to that. And then the third really big one for us is we give previews of the Friday editions. And that's a button I'm more hesitant to push. People don't love running into a paywall in their inbox, which I totally understand. I don't love it either. But when I publish a piece that's a little bit controversial, maybe, or something that I think has some juice behind it, and we send the first third of it to the email list and we put a paywall in, you know, we'll get 10 emails from those 9,500,000 people saying, or whatever, 90,000 free subscribers saying, you know, this sucks that you did this and it's really annoying to run into a paywall, but 150 of them will get paid subscriptions. And so that's a trade-off for me. That's worth it. And while I don't love the kind of the little sort of subtle looping in there that's necessary, it's also necessary for me to pay my team and keep the lights on. So it's something we kind of have to do.
And so just so I understand the tactic, you will send an email to the paid list with a partial post. And then it's just basically like, if you want to read the full thing, you got to become a member.
The free list. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it'll, you know, it'll be the first quarter or third of an edition. And oftentimes I'll put a note at the top that just says, you know, I publish on Ghost, and they have a feature that allows you to sort of include a piece of text that only shows for free subscribers. So you send it to the full list and you put a little, you know, like a preview bar in there that creates a button, you know, that encourages people to subscribe. But at the top, I'll say, just a heads up, this email is going to have a paywall, you know, about halfway through or whatever it is. And you'll be asked to subscribe to read the whole thing. And yeah, if the topic is interesting, that converts really well usually.
And so you said that the free list gets four newsletters. And then the paid list gets two additional newsletters. How did you find that balance between free and paid? Like, why did you decide that was the way to do it?
Yeah. So truly in the beginning, I was publishing 5 days a week to everybody. And I did that almost for the entire first year, until I got to maybe 5,000 people on the mailing list. And I turned on paid subscriptions as a just support us type ask. And we converted something like 20% of that initial batch of subscribers, which I was thrilled about, because I was told to expect, you know, maybe 3-5%. And that was a signal to me that people were just, you know, genuinely interested in supporting the work. And there was kind of a mission-oriented nature of it. And in response, my sense was that audience was big enough that they should get something that's special and specific and outside the normal offering. And so we just started paywalling the Friday editions. They were just normal versions of the newsletter, but just behind a paywall on Fridays. And then I sort of iterated from that into, God, I would love a little bit of space to just write about whatever I want outside the daily Tangle format. And then that's kind of what the Friday editions turned into. The Sunday newsletter is pretty much brand new. I think it's maybe 3 months old. And that was a product of two things. One, people who were unsubscribing, the number one reason they unsubscribed was they said it was too many emails. So they would get behind, you know, they'd have 8-10 unread emails in their inbox from Tangle, and it would really stress them out. And so we were thinking, let's create sort of a churn bust email for that, where we can say, hey, don't unsubscribe. We'll push you to a Sunday once a week newsletter where we'll just send you summaries of what we covered that week, and you only get it once a week. So our initial idea was just this churn busting newsletter. And then as we started thinking about the Sunday edition, we were like, oh, we should put some other cool features in here besides the roundup. And then we were like, maybe this is a premium type product that we can launch as something that's actually an incentive for people to pay. And even the people who are unsubscribing because there's too many emails, maybe they'll pay just to get access to this once a week roundup. And this all was happening around a time that we were thinking about raising our prices a bit. So what we settled on was, let's pair a bump in our subscription price with the launch of this product. And we'll tell our audience, like, you know, prices have gone up, cost is going up everywhere. We're going to bump our prices up, but we don't want to do it without offering something new. So we're adding this additional feature to the paid package. And that in the end was how it came out.
And so you mentioned that you've started exploring and introducing some advertising. What have been the products and what types of advertisers have you been working with?
Yeah. So I think a lot of the ones that you probably see around the newsletter space, I mean, we get everything from sort of supplement type stuff that, you know, we have to do some more than usual vetting to other newsletters. I think today we advertised Masterworks, which is kind of like an investment type. You'd probably know better than I would. We get hearing aids. People want to advertise that in our newsletter, I suppose, because email audiences maybe skew a little bit older. We've advertised Babbel. We've advertised other political news outlets like Dispatch. So all sorts of different stuff comes across our desk. We do have an advertising policy around not taking any ad revenue from anybody that has political affiliations, basically, because of the work that we do. So, you know, not just political campaigns, but any kind of advocacy group or special interest group, we're not going to take any revenue from. I also, you know, I know there's a lot of money in some of the, you know, getting advertising from a Comcast or, you know, ExxonMobil or whatever. I mean, I see those ads all over Axios and Punchbowl and other really big dominant politics newsletters. That feels very icky to me personally, and I think is like damaging to our brand. So because we have so much subscription revenue, I think we kind of sacrifice that and we say we're not going to take that money. It's hard sometimes, I have to admit, because I'd love to have, you know, really big, expensive premium advertisements with obscene amounts of money that those groups throw around. But I think from a brand perspective, it's smarter for us long term not to. And maybe I think our consumers are more conscious than they are. But, you know, given what we're trying to build, it's just one of the ways that we're trying to be a little bit different.
And so how much revenue does Tangle generate in total? And is the business itself profitable?
The business is profitable. It's been profitable since it started, because I actually launched it when I had another job, and I quit it the moment that I quit my day job the moment the revenue surpassed what my salary was, which was a really good feeling. And so ever since then, you know, we've been even or in the green. We are coming up on a total $1 million annual recurring revenue this year. I hope that'll happen in the next couple months. I think, you know, right now our subscription revenue alone is something like, you know, mid 800s or something like that. And we get another 70 or 80 grand a year from the ad revenue. So we have a team of five people, five full-time employees, myself included. And we have some part-time editors, we have some interns, And, you know, the majority of our expenses are that it's payroll. We're all remote. I have an office space here that I'm talking to you from, but most of the team is remote or in some shared office space. And, you know, we put a ton of money back into all the subscription services we pay for to read all the news, which is actually a huge expense, website maintenance, things like that. But we are definitely profitable. We put away a couple hundred grand last year, which felt really good for me because this is the first time I've had a full team under me. This last year, we hired three other full-time people. I had before that just a team of part-time folks. And I really wanted the kind of safety net of like, if we have a few bad months of growth or things go south or there's some major economic disruption, that it's not going to be a layoffs for everyone type situation. So we've kind of got our rainy day fund put away now, which feels good. And, you know, going forward, I want to invest as much of that sort of cash that I can into just growth, into finding new readers and advertising our newsletter and other platforms. I'm hopeful that we can do that. But right now, there's some headwinds. I mean, I think people are generally a little bit exhausted by the politics and news space. And that's something we're definitely running into.
I want to come back to that in a second, but as we look at, you know, you had 5,000 people, now you're over 90,000. We've talked about your conversion from free to paid, but the vast majority of your readers are still unpaid. So how are you growing that top of funnel? What tactics have you found work to grow the free list?
I mean, so the one that is the least consistent, but the most tried and true is just generating great content and going viral. You know, I mean, that is the kind of lightning in the bottle stuff that you can't really teach. And I think, you know, there isn't a formula to it. You know, I think last year, one of our biggest weeks of growth was basically I posted a version of my take from the newsletter onto Twitter in their long form new tweets that they allow. And it was literally a copy and paste from my take in the newsletter about the initial attacks in Israel on October 7th. And that tweet got, you know, I don't know, 30 or 40 million views. Elon Musk replied to it. You know, the president of TED Talks retweeted it. There was all this stuff. And we just saw in a matter of days that, you know, our newsletter list grew by 5,000 people and, you know, 20% of them came in as paid subscribers. And all of a sudden you're looking at a $50,000 a year bump in annual revenue that happens in a few days. And it snowballs. So then I got invited on MSNBC and I went on some podcasts, and every one of those, you know, appearances kind of gives you that long tail. So, you know, a lot of people kind of up and coming ask me about, you know, what are the best ways to grow the newsletter? I really do think the answer is, and will always be, content is king. You know, you produce something that's new, that's fresh, that people genuinely want, you're going to win. If you try and copy what exists out there that a bunch of people are already doing, it's going to be really hard. You have to do it really, really well, better than they're doing it. We advertise in other newsletters. Obviously, I think a lot of people who get their news from emails are, you know, that's the prototypical customer that we want, because the newsletter is our core product. So I go out and, you know, if I see a newsletter I really like, or there feels like there's an audience that might overlap with us, I'll inquire about what their advertising costs are and do some plugs. We have a share button in every newsletter right in the middle of it, and an ask for readers to spread the word. And we CC ourselves in the auto-generated email when they click the button, so we can see how many people are using it. And every day there's still people who are sending those emails and passing the word on about us. So, you know, I think a lot of stuff that is kind of already out there, my view is, you know, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. I am trying to experiment a bit more with social ad spends. I generally think that it's a money pit and it's a little bit dangerous, but I think there are some really smart people out there who know how to run those campaigns, and I'm trying to find them and use them. And yeah, aside from that, it's leaning on the network that the readers have and getting them to push stuff out for you and forward the email to five friends or whatever it is. And then knowing and having a sense of when you have a really good piece of content. And then the last thing I'll just say is we're hitting other channels. We launched a YouTube channel this year. We've had a couple of nice little hits there, you know, videos that got 30 or 40,000 views, which in the YouTube space is nothing, but for us, it's 30, 40,000 people who have never seen our brand before. And we've seen a little spike, you know, we put the URL to our website in the episode description or whatever, and we'll see a little spike on the newsletter mailing list when we have a video do really well on YouTube, because people are trying to learn more about us and they find our website and they sign up for our newsletter. And so that's going to be the kind of the next frontier, I think, is expanding outside the newsletter website space and focusing a lot more on our podcast and our YouTube channel.
There is a lot going on at media companies, whether that's media planning, ad operations, customer service, you name it, there are things to do. And that means you need people to do those tasks and managers to manage those people. All of this critical work is resource intensive, and this year it is sure to get busier. What if there was another way? Enter SEBPO. SEBPO is a leading global outsourcing partner that serves the advertising, media, and technology industries by taking on your organization's repeatable back-end tasks. With staff in the United States, Bangladesh, and El Salvador, SEBPO teams become an integral part of your company by taking on the multitude of tasks required to run an efficient media company. And this isn't just about throwing people at the problem. SEBPO follows an in-depth implementation process that ensures they execute the right strategies and supporting tasks to help your business thrive. Then, they deploy the necessary team and partner with you to train them on your processes. SEBPO will help you scale your business and allow you to focus on the strategies and tasks that require your expertise. If you're interested in learning more about outsourcing these sorts of tasks and more, email sales@sebpo.com or visit sebpo.com to set up a call. So you mentioned that you're dealing with increasing headwinds with the audience, with growth. There's a lot to unpack there. Why do you think this is happening? What are these headwinds?
So I would say, you know, if you looked at our chart, you know, our growth chart, it's up and to the right. And I think over time, I switched platforms. I went from Substack to Ghost. So I don't have a great linear from beginning to today graph of the subscriber growth. But I would say over time, it's probably pretty consistent with like some periods of flatness. I think right now we are in a quiet time for a few reasons. One, the last year or two, we've been out of election season, which is a really natural growth time for us. I'm hopeful that over the next 6 or 8 months, people are really going to start to tune in to what's coming in 2024, and that'll help us a lot. Two, there's tons of polling and, you know, media surveys and data from people who track, you know, website traffic and things like that. That interest in political news is down across the board. Washington Post, CNN, you know, New York Times, Fox News, whatever, all their ratings and their traffic are all down, and they've been down over the last year. And I think that is specific to us, just a reflection of the fact that there's a ton of news fatigue out there. And, you know, there's so many people who are just like, I can't have another space where I'm just getting political news thrown into my face, and they don't want it in their inbox. And I get that. When people unsubscribe, they get an auto email from us asking why they unsubscribe. You know, the multiple emails a week thing is one of the big reasons we get. And the other one is I'm just exhausted and I like can't take reading about the news anymore. So I think that sentiment is sort of spreading across the country. And we're trying to think about how to position ourselves advantageously for that by saying like, all you need to do is spend 10 minutes with us a day, and you don't have to read anything else. We'll cover it. We'll filter out what's important and show you that. And I'm hoping that's a message that resonates for the people that have a little bit of the news fatigue, but I don't know. We'll see. I think it's going to be a battle. I think as people get more and more interested in what's happening in the election, and as the 2024 election gets closer, I'm hoping and assuming that people are going to be interested enough to tune in. But right now, that feels really prescient. And I would say the other thing is, advertising across the newsletter space is struggling. And I've seen that, places like Morning Brew, who's, they built the roadmap for the rest of us in a lot of ways, they're laying people off and their revenue's down and that they're having financial troubles. And I think the whole ad industry in the news world is struggling, but I think that is genuinely a product of the fact that they have a less engaged audience today than they did 3 or 4 years ago. And I don't think that's because their product's worse. I think it's just like the space is really saturated. There's a lot of newsletters. There's a lot of options to get your news. Tons of different people have popped up into the space. And so for us, it's just, we're another competitor among a bunch of other people who are coming up behind us too. When I started my newsletter, Substack was barely known by anyone. I was one of the, I was on like top five politics newsletters on Substack for a while because there's nobody else on there. And now it's like Substack is almost a household name. I mean, it's amazing how much they've grown, in terms of being mainstreamed. The brand is obviously taking some hits from some of the controversies and stuff they've had. And I'm no longer on Substack, but there's so many people who are running prominent newsletters there. And they're all people that folks can choose to read over me. So yeah, I think competition's up, news fatigue is up, saturation of the space is up. And there's a little bit less big money interest in supporting these kinds of news outfits because a lot of media companies are failing right now.
I will do a slight fact check only because I was the publisher at Morning Brew. business is fine. Business is, certainly more competition. I don't think there have been layoffs in a year, but
that long ago, a year?
Yeah, it's been a while. But anyway, I won't dig in any more deeper because former employer and all that.
Hey, that's a good fact check. I mean, my understanding from talking to people there was just that, the rates for an advertisement placement or whatever had gone down. They actually started doing something that was interesting too, which was I wanted to advertise in Morning Brew, and they're not advertising other newsletters anymore, which I thought was super interesting. I mean, that was the reason they told me they wouldn't take my money, which I didn't feel like, but that I thought that was pretty, curious about how where the space is, that like there's a kind of competitor posture that I think a lot of people are having because so many people are trying to copy what they're doing. And, and I feel like I've been around for a while now after 5 years, but, I was a new kid on the block to them at the time. And now there's all these other people coming up behind me that I just think there's so much competition. It's changing the landscape a bit.
And do you think as the campaigns continue to go on that and as the partisanship gets stronger, right? I mean, it looks like it's going to be Trump versus Biden and it's going to be like an absolute dogfight. Do you think that that is an advantage for you, or do you have any concerns that the audience will just disengage even more because you're not feeding the angst and the tribalism?
Great question. I think that 8 years ago, maybe that would be a disadvantage for me. I think today it's an advantage. I think part of the news fatigue is people are tired of that sort of blue versus red, hate the other side kind of setup. And there's a general angst about turning on the news and what you're going to have to deal with and hear. And I think people are starting to realize, from where I'm sitting, there's so many interesting things happening right now, kind of in that vein, like Chris Cuomo sitting down with Tucker Carlson for an interview. I mean, this sort of CNN, Fox News, ex-anchors kind of shaking hands and trying to make a truce. Don Lemon interviewing Elon Musk. There's these big players in the media space that I think are realizing these sort of cross-partisan conversations are intriguing to people right now. And we've been doing that for a while, but there's a lot more of it that's starting to happen. And so I think readers, listeners, viewers are getting more interested in that. And, you know, there's a reason guys like Lex Fridman or Joe Rogan or whoever else are, they're so popular and they have such a huge audience. And it's because they come to issues with like a sense of humility, and they give people, you know, open space to kind of share their views, and they interview people with a wide range of different perspectives, and audiences are clearly very interested in that right now. And so my hope, my wish is that people are kind of ready to step out of their partisan bubbles a little bit. In 2022, I made the rather audacious claim, I think, that partisanship might be hitting rock bottom in the US. And I'm hoping we see a little bit of that bounce into 2024. Biden and Trump are going to do their best to stop it from happening, I'm sure. But I think people are sort of tired of the pony show at this point.
You've started to experiment with small scale events. What's the strategy here?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I just really wanted to get an in-person taste of our community and see what they were all about. And to me, there was just something really exciting about bringing what we do in the newsletter on stage and having people come out and experiencing it. We've done one live event in Philadelphia last summer, and we have another one coming up in about a month, April 17th. And the first event in Philly was, I mean, it was honestly magical for me. It was so cool to meet all these people, fill a room of 200 people. Some came from California and Texas and Virginia. I mean, people who were really, really invested in what we were doing and felt on the ground floor of this new media company. And that was super cool. And the event went great. It went off without a hitch. We had a really interesting, I thought, kind of moderated debate about the state of the Supreme Court. Did some reader questions at the end, some audience questions at the end to sort of mimic our reader questions. And, you know, we just want to get people to kind of walk the walk on this sort of open-mindedness and dialogue and experience it and do it in person. We're going to see how this New York event goes. I mean, it's already sold out, which is awesome. We still have some VIP tickets left for any New Yorkers who want to come check it out. But we, you know, we generally are of the opinion that we can make a really creative and compelling evening of kind of entertainment and experience by just bringing the sort of ethos and structure that we have in the newsletter and the podcast to the stage. So I don't know if we'll make money on this event in New York. We had a great sponsor for the Philly event, so we actually did really well there. We're still looking to secure a second sponsor for the New York event that I hope will kind of put us over in the green. But whether we do or don't, our goal is to bring this to a few other cities in the Northeast and then kind of start expanding westward. You know, we want to hit the concentration centers where we have a high volume of readers and especially paid subscribers who we think are the most likely to come out and see the event. So we can kind of use the newsletter, the mailing list as a guidepost for, you know, a Tangle tour. You know, I don't want to be on the road 5 months out of the year. That's not something I'm interested in. But I think doing, you know, four or five events a year and having them grow and get bigger and bigger and sort of walking the walk on this sort of open dialogue and debate and diverse audience politically and get people from across the political spectrum to come sit in the same room together and experience something like this together is good for the country and is probably a good way to make some money too. I think, you know, a lot of different media companies have proven that events are a lucrative path forward. So I would love for it to be a great business venture for us too, as well as a really good experience.
And I know that you started on Substack, but what is the full technology stack that you use to power Tangle?
We're on Ghost now. Ghost.org is the platform that we use. I love Ghost. I mean, and I love Substack. Honestly, you know, people ask me all the time, other newsletter writers will come and say, hey, I'm thinking about switching off Substack or coming to Ghost, or, you know, I'm curious why you left Substack or how you like it. There's only one reason I left Substack, and it's because they take 10% of fee on your revenue. And we got to a point where we're making $200,000 a year, and 20 grand a year was a salary for somebody, you know, like, or a part-time person, obviously not a full salary, but I could get part-time help with 20 grand a year. And I was not ready to just pay a newsletter service for that. I think Substack is an incredible tool, and I love the guys over there. I think they're awesome. I think they're really smart. I think they're going to end up allowing ads and other things like that, that other newsletters do. I think they're bound to sort of cave on that. It sounds like they're already moving in that direction. But Ghost is awesome because it's independent. They have really, really good customer service. The website and all that stuff is a lot more dynamic. You can kind of build what you want. So if you have any kind of technical sophistication, which I do not, but a lot of people do, you can sort of make whatever you want to make over there. So I have Ghost. And then I also use this company called Outpost that is kind of like the in-between but for me and Ghost. They sort of manage my website and help with all the welcome flow stuff and set up all sorts of different features whenever I say, hey, I want to try this or that. And they've been really helpful, awesome team over there too. But yeah, for me, you know, it was just like we wanted a little bit more freedom and I wanted to save that money. You know, I think we have whatever, 100,000 members, and on Ghost, we pay still a fraction of that, you know, $20,000 I was paying Substack when I had 30 or 40,000 members. So it's a lot cheaper and it gives us some more flexibility. And you know, the other problem Substack's having right now is they have like some brand stuff where there's a lot of chatter in the media world and that there's this specific brand of person that's on Substack, which wasn't an issue when I left. But I think if I were there right now would be something that concerned me a little bit. So I'm glad to be on kind of a lesser known in the background type platform where, you know, there's no kind of association with it.
Now, the Tangle started as a solo operation, but you've started bringing on a team. And as someone who is at the solo stage, I'm the only one for AMO, and thinking about bringing on people, can you talk through what made you decide to start hiring and where you made your initial investments on people?
Yeah, so the thing that made me start hiring was twofold. I mean, one, simple terms, the work just became too much to do on my own. All I could do was write the newsletter and send it out. And you know, I was coming from a newsroom background, so I knew that we needed a social media operation. We needed an ad ops operation. We needed editors. We needed all this stuff that I didn't have. And I really just missed the team. I would say that was kind of the big second reason was I love being in the trenches with a group of people and I love being in a team atmosphere. And I just didn't love working alone. So when we hit a certain revenue, I think it was probably, you know, 100 grand or something like that a year in revenue, I started looking for some part-time help. And the first person that I hired is the woman who to this day is kind of like my right hand. Her name is Magdalena Bukova, and she runs our social media and now she runs our ad operations. And I just got somebody who had a different skill set than me. So, you know, she had graphic design skills, social media background. She had done lots of local reporting as a journalist rather than national reporting. She was interested in sort of getting involved on the sales side, doing kind of business operation stuff, a lot of the things I didn't want to do. And yeah, she was the best first decision I made was bringing her on. And, you know, she's been with me ever since. And after she was in, it was sort of like a decision about what we needed as a unit, like where were our blind spots. So I had some part-time editors from the beginning. Actually, my dad used to just copy edit the newsletter for me before I sent it out. So it was kind of this mom and pop shop. And then one of my old college buddies, I was in a writing group with, was editing the newsletter in his free time for like an hour or two every day while he was at his job as a programmer. And he was such a good editor. I mean, I've had tons of different editors throughout my career, and he was so good that I just eventually offered him a full-time position to come on and help support me. And now he works under the managing editor title. And then we launched the podcast and the YouTube channel. So I needed someone who could edit podcasts and YouTube. So I hired that person. And then the last hire we made is a guy who he's an editor, he's a researcher, he's a booking person, you know, in some capacity, he almost functions as like an assistant of mine, where it's just like everything that is overflow for me, I ask him to help pick up the slack. He's a younger guy who came from a public policy and PR background and just has a lot of really transferable skills. And that is essentially our team. So, you know, we all work as a unit together and cover those different channels. And we have some part-time people and some interns who help out a little bit on the fringes, but, it's basically just fine. For me, it was finding people who were good at things that I couldn't do. And then, you know, this last hire was bringing in somebody who could do the things I could do and take some stuff off my plate personally, because it just got to be too much, basically.
So you've mentioned that people feel an attachment to you, right? That you put your piece in each newsletter, and when the, you know, the twice a year email comes out asking for money, you talk about like there's a connection to you. You put your photo in there. How do you think about the evolution of Tangle, where at some point you might want to step back? How do you evolve the brand where it's not the Isaac Show, but it's the Tangle Show?
A big conversation we're having right now. It's really hard. So I have a few different ideas about how we might do it. I mean, I think fundamentally what I'm doing right now is not sustainable. I think, you know, if I made any mistake, which who knows, maybe it wasn't a mistake, but in retrospect, if I could change anything, it's that I wouldn't be a daily. I mean, it's so hard to produce this volume of content on a weekly basis. And it basically means, you know, my only day off is Saturday, and the drumbeat just never stops, and I'm working 12-hour days. So, you know, I know that I can't keep doing this for the long term. So we have a few different ideas. I think one is introducing the staff as, you know, contributors, or even hiring people expressly for the purpose of writing, and kind of have this character group that takes different newsletters on individual days throughout the week. The other is just making what is right now my take, our take, quote unquote, and becoming more like an editorial team, Tangle the team. And the risk of that is we sort of lose a little bit of that personal connection. And that's what I'm really scared of. And, you know, I've thought about different things I could do. Like, for instance, you know, I mentioned the Friday editions are behind a paywall. Like, what if every Friday edition was, that was me, that was like my space, Tangle CEO, founder, whatever, where I get to write about whatever I want. And then I have one newsletter a week, and the rest of the week is sort of this our take section. That's just kind of like, you know, the whole team is working on it together. I think there are different ways to play with that, but yeah, it's a really big challenge. It's, you know, early on, I mean, I sent my first newsletter to 13 people. So this was not a problem I was thinking about back then. I was just trying to make a little bit of supplemental income and build something I thought people would read. And now I'm in this spot where I'm like, oh shit, like I need to like find a way to detach myself from the brand, but keep people really interested in me. So, you know, maybe it's just I'm the podcast host and I write this one edition a week, and you know, we have the rest of the week be in the newsletter, but I'm really not sure. And I think it's going to become even more interesting if or when we start to kind of franchise Tangle out a little bit, which I think is something long term we could do. I mean, I'd love to jump verticals, Tangle Sports, you know, like one big sports debate a day, something like that. I'd love to go international. I'd love to go down to the state level, you know, bring this format that we have, which I think is part of our special sauce, to, you know, France, or bring it to Pennsylvania and just find the kind of Isaac of France or the Isaac of Pennsylvania, and give a writer, a reporter like that, some seed money to start a newsletter and then share the profits with them. I think that's a model that could work. That's pretty long term, but yeah, it's going to be really tough. If you have any suggestions, I'm totally open for some advice, because it's something we're trying to figure out right now.
I appreciate that. I'm also, it's something I'm thinking about too, and we can always talk about that. You started talking a little bit about the future. Where do you see Tangle over the next 3 to 5 years?
I am of the opinion that I do not want to become the next New York Times or CNN or whatever. You know, I'm not trying to build a newsroom. I want to build a really well-paid, lucrative team that's doing, you know, a really well-paid team doing lucrative work that's really important and feels kind of mission-oriented. I would love to have sort of the, you know, Cook Political Report, kind of like this family mom and pop type business, $25 million a year in revenue, whatever they're doing, and they employ 8 people. I mean, that's a great ratio to me. That's like, you know, you have this small team that knows each other and loves each other and is committed to the work they're doing, and a really loyal audience that's willing to pay for your service because it's so valuable, and everybody makes a bunch of money. I'd love that. That's kind of my North Star. And I think in order to do that, we have to stay focused and move slow. So, you know, as much as I want to do the Tangle franchise or Tangle Sports or whatever, a lot of that is still a distraction. I mean, we have to get the newsletter to 1 million subs instead of, you know, 90 or 100,000. We have to get our revenue to 5 million instead of 1 million. We want to build this YouTube channel. We want to build the podcasts. And that stuff is starting to happen now and it's starting to build, but I know it's a slow grind. But yeah, for me, like a small, really tight-knit, well-paid team is kind of what I'm shooting for, versus, you know, take a bunch of seed money and pay for an audience and, you know, build out like a 100-person newsroom or whatever. I have no interest in doing that. And, you know, who knows what happens along the way. If there's a path for me to step back and work less, and maybe there's a partner or a sale, or who knows? I mean, I keep my options open. I'm open-minded to a lot of that stuff. But right now, I feel like we're doing really important work. We have a sustainable business model. I have an incredible team of people that I really love to work with around me. And I'd love to pay all of them super well and make a bunch of money and do something that feels like important, positive work in the media space. And that's kind of what I'm focused on.
I want to end with the same two questions that I ask every operator that comes on the show. First, what is a mistake that you have made in your career, and what did you learn from it?
I mean, I've made a lot of mistakes. Definitely have made a lot of mistakes. At the risk of being redundant, I would say, you know, in the context of this conversation, the biggest mistake I made when I started Tangle was I didn't have enough trust in myself to think about where I wanted to be in 5 years. I was really short-sighted about the goal and my intention. It was like, I had this product idea for this newsletter format that I thought would work. I sort of had a mission statement that I wanted to get people out of their news bubble and bring people together a little bit. And I had the skills to pull all that off, but, you know, I didn't think about building a difference between Isaac and Tangle. I didn't think about any of the ramifications of doing a daily newsletter 5 days a week for the next 10 years. You know, I didn't think about a lot of the stuff that in retrospect were very obvious, sort of, where are you going with this? Like, what's your ultimate end goal? Because I had so little faith that it would succeed almost, you know, I was so day by day, I'm just going to try this, see how it works. And I think if I could go back to that version of myself, knowing that I had a chance at making this what it is today, I would have been more thoughtful about, you know, separating myself a little bit or what I had the capacity to do from a work volume perspective. And so for, you know, operators who are, I guess, in that kind of seed phase, trying to plant something or build something, I would say be really conscientious of that and think about, you know, really, if this goes well, where am I going to take it? And what do I want that to look like? Because I had all sorts of plans for if this didn't work and, you know, the fallback and plan B and all that stuff. But I didn't have a great plan for if it succeeded and what it would mean if it turned into the thing I was trying to make it turn into. So funny enough, that was kind of the one thing I wasn't prepared for in a lot of ways. And I think that's a mistake I reflect on a little bit.
And second, and perhaps building on that, what is some advice that you would give operators looking to grow their media businesses?
I would say the classic entrepreneurial advice that I use that I think is really handy is build the thing that you want. You know, I was so tired of reading the Washington Post, reading the Wall Street Journal, watching CNN, watching Fox News, listening to Ben Shapiro's podcast, listening to the Young Turks podcast, all about the same issue. And then at the end of the day being like, okay, I've spent 8 hours listening to all these different things. And now I think I understand what the right and left are saying about this issue. I wish I could find this in one place. That was my feeling. I wish this existed all in one place, compact, straight to the point, easy to consume. And so I built that thing that I wanted. And it turns out there's a ton of other people who also want that, who also want that information in one place. So, you know, I think about something that you want and understand the fact that if you want this product, there's probably a bunch of different yous out there. And then, you know, from a kind of really crude business idea, be really realistic about what you're offering and how valuable it is and how much it should cost people. You know, we just bumped our prices up and it has not slowed down our subscription conversions. It has not changed the way people think about us or how accessible we are to the people who want to pay for us. We went from $50 a year to $59 a year. And, you know, I basically increased our revenue by 20% a year for the new subscribers coming in. And it seems to have not changed anything in terms of our conversion rate. And I've been doing this for 4 or 5 years. And I was like, oh, we were underpriced. That's what that's telling me is like, I undervalued what we were offering. And there are other places who, you know, I go to subscribe to support them. And I'm like, no way, I'm not paying $250 a year for this. It's not nearly that valuable. And so, you know, be realistic, ask people. That's what we did. We asked people how they'd react to a price increase. When I launched paid subscriptions, I asked the audience how much they'd be willing to pay. And I undercut what they said they would pay, which was dumb in retrospect. But it's a really good practice. Just be really crudely honest with yourself about how valuable what you're offering is. And in either direction you go, you know, if it turns out you're less valuable than you think or more valuable, by pricing yourself right, you're going to make more money in the end, which I think is the goal for people who are trying to start a good business.
If you enjoyed this episode, hit subscribe and give it a 5-star rating with your thoughts. If you want even more, sign up for AMO Pro at amediaoperator.com. Each Tuesday, we analyze the latest media news, and throughout the week, we do deep dives into specific strategic and tactical topics about building media businesses. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.